Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. I'm hosting a Christmas Eve gathering tonight, so I'm doing this, sneaking it in. I'll probably still do one after the Christmas Eve gathering. Anyway, whatever, you don't care about that. My point is, I don't have a lot of time right now, but I do want to do this one, so this is going to be a quickie. It is a really short chapter too, which suits. This is Epilogue 2, Chapter 3. It goes like this. A locomotive is moving. Someone asks, what moves it? A peasant says the devil moves it. Another man says the locomotive moves because its wheels go round. A third asserts that the cause of its movement lies in the smoke which the wind carries away. The peasant is irrefutable. He has devised a complete explanation. To refute him, someone would have to prove to him that there is no devil, or another peasant would have to explain to him that it is not the devil, but a German who moves the locomotive. Only then, as a result of the contradiction, while they see that they are both wrong, but the man who says that the movement of the wheels is the cause, refutes himself, for having once started on analysis, he ought to go on and explain further why the wheels go round, until he has reached the ultimate cause of the movement of the locomotive in the pressure of the steam in the boiler. He has no right to stop in his search for the cause. The man who explains the movement of the locomotive by the smoke that is carried back has noticed that the wheels do not supply an explanation and has taken the first sign that occurs to him, and in his turn he has offered that as an explanation. The only conception that can explain the movement of the locomotive is that of a force commensurate with the movement observed. The only conception that can explain the movement of the peoples is that of some force commensurate with the whole movement of the peoples. Yet to supply this conception, various historians take forces of different kinds, all of which are incommensurate with the movement observed. Some see it as a force directly inherent in heroes, as the peasant sees the devil in the locomotive. Others as a force resulting from several other forces, like the movement of the wheels. Others again as an intellectual influence, like the smoke that is blown away. So long as histories are written of separate individuals, whether Caesars, Alexanders, Luthers or Voltaires, and not the histories of all, absolutely all, those who take part in an event, it is quite impossible to describe the movement of humanity without the conception of a force compelling men to direct their activity towards a certain end, and the only such conception known to historians is that of power. This conception is the one handle by means of which the material of history, as at present expounded, can be dealt with, and anyone who breaks that handle off, as Buckle did, without finding some other method of treating historical material, merely deprives himself of the one possible way of dealing with it. The necessity for the conception of power as an explanation of historical events is the best demonstrated by the universal historians and historians of culture themselves, for they professedly reject that conception, but inevitably have recourse to it at every step. In dealing with humanity's inquiry, the science of history up to now is like money in circulation, paper money and coin. The biographies and special national histories are like paper money, that can be used and can circulate and fulfill their purpose without harm to anyone, and even advantageously, as long as no one asks, what is the security behind them? You need only forget to ask how the will of heroes produces events, and such histories as theirs will be interesting and instructive and may perhaps even possess a tinge of poetry. But just as doubts of the real value of paper money arise, either because being easy to make, too much of it gets made, or because people try to exchange it for gold, so also doubts concerning the real value of such histories arise, either because too many of them are written, or because, in his simplicity of heart, someone inquires, by what force did Napoleon do this? That is, wants to exchange the current paper money for the real gold of actual comprehension. The writers of universal histories and of the history of culture are like people who, recognizing the defects of paper money, decide to substitute it for money made of metal that is not the specific gravity of gold. It may indeed make jingling coin, but will do no more than that. Paper money may deceive the ignorant, but nobody is deceived by tokens of base metal that have no value but merely jingle. As gold is gold only if it is serviceable not merely for exchange but also for use, so universal historians will only be valuable when they can reply to history's essential question, what is power? The universal historians give contradictory replies to that question, while the historians of culture evade it and answer something quite different, and as counters of imitation, gold can only be used among a group of people who agree to accept them as gold or among those who do not know the nature of gold, so universal historians and historians of culture not answering humanity's essential question only serve as currency for some purposes of their own in universities and among the mass of readers who have a taste for what they call serious reading. All right, there we go, another chapter down. I apologize for the background noise. There are children watching Toy Story in the background. But this is only a quickie. Mellow Yellow said, wow. Tolstoy is equating historians as counterfeiters and as a group substituting out truth as the gold standard of history. He really doesn't like historians. Actually, I like his metaphors. Some of them are a bit of a stretch, but to be honest, most of the time the metaphors are the only way I, in my daftness, can understand what he's talking about. Very cool. I like some of his metaphors. I like the money one, and how you've got gold, which is the real value, then money, which is only worthless paper, but it represents real gold, and then you've got counterfeit gold, and the difference between the three. That kind of was a good one. The first one, what was the first one about? That one was a bit of a stretch. Oh yeah, about the train. Yeah, the train one I didn't love, but yeah. Cobby X said, epilogue 2, the crowning jewel of the entirety of War and Peace. I'm suspecting that's sarcasm. And Biscuit Potter says, Tolstoy uses gold in his analogy as something with inherent value as opposed to paper money, which just has value because we say it does, but doesn't gold have value just because we decide it does? What is it actually good for besides being shiny and malleable? This is a genuine, not rhetorical question. What uses? All I can think of is jewelry, which also only has the value we ascribe to it. I do enjoy the analogies, though. They are my favorite part of his analysis. Tradana says, I think gold does have more physical, real-world applications than paper money, which just represents usefulness rather than being a useful thing itself. But value is a human construct and times change. If I were given the choice of a piece of gold or its equivalent value in real money, I know which one I would choose. Yeah, I think the point was that money, the value of money is based on gold. So $1 is $1 worth of gold, right? So paper money represents the value of gold at all times. I think that's the point he's making. So where gold has the inherent value, paper money or coins is only a representation of the inherent value of gold. Okay, does that make sense? Did I nail that? I also think gold does have some uses, some applications. Like, for example, jewelry. It might be just superficial value, but it's still inherent value because we like it, right? But you can't make paper money into jewelry. You can't wear that around your neck. It also has uses in manufacturing and commercial uses. Most of the value of it is just, like you said, Biscuit Potter, because we sort of decided that it is worth that much. But the value of gold is, it's like the commodity, whereas the money just represents the price of the commodity. Anyway, let's not get bogged down in that. See, this is the thing with these analogies. I don't like them because now we're discussing, like we're breaking down the analogy in terms of gold and money, where what was he even trying to describe? I literally can't remember what he was trying to describe. Oh yeah, historians and the different values of different historians. I think he would have been better to just describe that rather than sway off into analogy, because you start to break down the analogy and it falls apart. My idea of analogies, because I'm a writer, so I have, you know, it's one of the tools of my trade, so to speak. Now, for what it's worth, I'm no Tolstoy, but analogies and metaphors are for me like guitar solos, right? Some of them are great because they serve the song and they're just a bit of the music, right? Listen to John Frusciante pull a solo. He's not showing off. He's playing the music. But then you got the guitarists who, it's just a technical feat. They're just kind of showing off what they can do. And it kind of doesn't even really work with the song. It doesn't serve the song. And you get those like tech bands where that's kind of what it is. It's like a portfolio of their technical skills. You go and watch them live and they're like, oh, and I can do this thing and I can do this thing. And I can do this faster than anyone else. And this one I can do the second fastest in the world at this technique. It's just like you're forgetting that this is music, not a technical display showcase. And it becomes a term that's used, a bit vulgar, but it's used in the music world as masturbatory, right? These solos become masturbatory because the person's just showing off. And I think of analogies in that way. They need to serve the purpose of an analogy, which is to make something easier to understand, right? Now, Tolstoy just goes slightly too far with his. Like, it should be a sort of one-to-one comparison, but when you start bringing in, like, all these other aspects of the analogy and trying to fit it into the thing you're explaining, it goes too far. He goes, for my taste, he goes way, like 10 steps too far with his analogies, where it's just him sort of showing off his knowledge of things. Like the thing with the locomotive, at a certain point, he was just showing off the fact that he knows how a train works, right? Yeah, I don't know. It's not for me, but very much a personal opinion. So I know some people love his analogies. All right, time to check out. Just a quick one. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you later.